errors or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, and AVU Technologies. Now here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today we'll be joined by AFGE National President John Gage, Grantham University President Dr. Frederick Snow, and author James Green. Welcome back to Inside Government, John Gage.
Thank you.
So let's talk about your reaction to President Obama's State of the Union address. What did you think?
Well, I was somewhat disappointed, especially when you add in the reaction from the Republican address, and of course Bachman's address too, the Tea Party group. But you know, I would have liked the president to really reinforce the history, the story of these deficits. You know, in 2000, we had a $3.4 trillion surplus. Tax cuts, two wars, the financial meltdown, and here we are. But for the president, you know, to say, all right, we're going to cut discretionary spending. I mean, last year he said we were going to freeze it for 3 years. Now we're freezing it for 5 years. But how does this discretionary spending, which it's financing, you know, VA nurses, meat inspectors, you know, people in Social Security, the ones who get you the right check at the right time, how does cutting that do anything? And especially when you're talking about a investment in infrastructure, what is being cut is infrastructure. And I keep saying that this recession we're in, this is about jobs, this is about revenue, demand has fallen, and how do you talk about new jobs and then attack the ones you already have? So I just wish that then the Republicans, well, they're I think really off the reservation. And when I say that, federal employees have one thing on their side: facts. And if we can get this discussion, debate in this country onto facts rather than this ideological, you know, hatred with government. If we can break down what government is, and not just leave it out there as this pejorative word that people want to, you know, in some parts of, well, the Tea Party just want to, I don't think it's less government, it sounds like it's no government. But we have to let people know that this isn't the cause of the deficit. You know, we've had these programs inspecting our food, our drugs, you know, improving water and air. You know, we've had these for quite a while. They operate pretty good. They are not bloated. They are not, you know, incompetent. They are not a waste. They perform a huge purpose in our infrastructure. And to just say, okay, we're going to wipe that out, and even if you do, it still has no effect on this deficit. We got to grow our way here. And I just think these cuts are symbolic, and it's the worst kind of symbolism. It feeds the frenzy of people who just don't like government, and you know, they cut government, and that money goes right to the top 2% in the country. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, I think. And so I'm just a little disappointed. I wish the president would have stood up strong for his workers. We are trying to do really the best possible for him and his administration. We believed him when he said an era of good government was coming in. And I just think kowtowing to these really know-nothing interests are just the wrong way to go.
Now, you raise an excellent point about the infrastructure of government. I mean, that's what we're really talking about with these freezes, these cuts. Yeah, we know the president wants a two-year pay freeze for federal employees, but what are your thoughts on this Republican Study Committee's proposed spending freeze for the next decade and reducing the federal workforce, which is really the infrastructure?
Yeah, it's, I don't, I think a lot of these folks, I saw a couple of them on TV the other day, and they were being grilled about, well, what do you cut? Well, we don't know. Well, what's government do? Well, spend money. I mean, they're very superficial, you know, inflammatory political statements. And really, we do need a intelligent, you know, debate and discussion and information on what the federal workforce does. And I think that is number one. I think that's the job of our union, too. We have to get out there like we've never been out there before and making people understand that, you know, the VA, that's government. You know, Social Security workers, they're government. Meat inspectors, that's government, too. Mine inspectors. And people, I might be a little naive on this, but I really don't believe people feel or think of those programs and those services and that infrastructure when they hear this government mantra that some of the right wings just keep throwing out there. So you know, that's what we're going to try to do. We're bringing in a ton of people in 2 weeks, and we're going to lobby the hell out of the Senate, and then go back home and be in every congressional representative's office to bang that point that federal workers are not the problem. The federal workers didn't get us into this deficit. They're not going to get us out of it. And I think we have the facts to back that up.
And you mentioned AFG's fighting back on this attack on federal workers. Folks are coming in. Let's get a little more specific. What kinds of things are people going to talk about? I mean, obviously we need to educate all of these legislators about what federal employees do. How will we do some of that?
Well, I think we're going to, you know, first of all, find out where they stand and try to when they say that we have to cut, hold their feet to the fire. Cut what? Cut where? And have them make a connection to cuts. If they're talking about cutting pay, they're talking about cutting benefits. How, in the midst of a powerful recession, does further cutting the demand side help? And isn't that just part of keep digging? I mean, how do you reduce unemployment when you're saying, well, we're going to get rid of 200,000 government workers? We don't care what they do. We don't care if they're valuable. We don't care what. We're just going to get rid of them. That is not good enough. I think the American public, and I almost promised myself I was going to say American public. I must have heard it 50,000 times just this week. But I don't think the people in this country really want that. And I think it has to be shown that the people who are advertising, the people who are advocating this, are ones who hate these programs. But that these programs really were created for working people. Many places to protect working people. Getting rid of them is, by a group who never liked them, so to funnel money back to the richest in this country is, I think, very disingenuous. And I think we have facts behind that. So we're gonna get up. I don't want to say that we're gonna get in people's faces, but I tell you, we're gonna demand some answers, and we're gonna demand some facts, and we're gonna demand that some of these people really back up their bumper sticker and cliche political talk.
And as you mentioned, you know, in a way, when people talk about cutting a certain percentage out of the budget or a certain number of federal employees, it is almost cowardly if you don't really say from where those cuts are going to be made. Let's talk for a minute about some of the folks that AFG represents. What kinds of things people do? I mean, they work in law enforcement. They protect the veterans, national defense. Let's talk about that.
Well, when you say, okay, we're going to cut federal salaries and federal benefits, and then the next thing out of their mouth is, well, these people are making $150,000-$160,000, they're overpaid. And now that is really an ignorant statement. Apparently, they don't realize what a nursing assistant, the VA, starts at, you know, what a TSA, TSO officer, you know, starts at, what a Border Patrol person starts at. These are all under $40,000. These are not people getting rich being a federal employee. Yet the impression that's intentionally being put out there is that everybody in the federal government makes $150,000. And it's... again, you know, facts matter, and I just hope. Here's the real problem we have as federal employees, that we get run over in a CR brinkmanship type negotiation that could happen in March, or this debt ceiling vote that could happen in April, that these folks, these anti-government folks, just put up completely unreasonable demands, or they'll shut down the government in either case. So our problem as a federal union representing the best interest of federal employees is to really, I mean, we are gearing up quickly. We are moving in our lobbying effort, and our educational effort, and our media effort very quickly, because I'm more concerned about the short term, even though the long term doesn't look so pretty good either. But I'm really concerned about the short term, what can happen in the next couple months.
And really, in these next couple months, if there are those cutbacks, let's talk about their services that these folks provide. I mean, this is not some theoretical cut. We're going to be talking about services to the American people that will go unmet.
Well, you know, when we're in a recession, especially a strong one, recession like this, government work goes up, especially when you have a couple wars going on. You know, the VA is busy. Social Security, in these times, many people can't get a job, file for disability. And some of them, many of them deserve disability. It's just that they don't have the job now and they can't work, and so disability is all they have. So, you know, the Social Security offices are full. I think disability claims are going up about 500,000 a year. So people, those cases won't be looked at. Service will go down. People will get angry when they're trying to keep body and soul together and can't get a case can't get their case adjudicated. The same thing with on the veteran side, with the veterans coming back and applying for military or service connected disabilities, and then all the it'll be free rein on companies. There'll be less workplace safety inspections. There'll be less environmental inspections. The whole infrastructure that was built to protect the American people and workers just is weakened. And it's not like you can punch this thing up when you decide, oh, well, that's gone too far, we have to get these cases looked at. You just don't punch that up. And I believe that the federal workers have been acting and performing, you know, very, very well. Every time you read the paper, it's kind of a morale killer, but in spite of that, I think our people have been really working hard. I think the secretaries of this administration have, you know, tried to keep the departments together, you know, in morale. But, you know, when you see that you're going to lose your health insurance, or you're going to be paying much more for less health insurance, when you see your retirement that may go from a 7% contribution to higher than a 15% contribution, and for less benefits, and your pay is going to be frozen for who knows how long if the Tea Party folks have their say, that kills all the momentum and initiative and that we've been trying to instill in federal employees. I mean, the best and brightest, forget that notion. So it's a depressing thing. And but I think the American, I can't see how any rational person can say, all right, we're going to make up this deficit by hammering these just this small part of the government. They call it discretionary spending, which is a terrible term, but it's about, you know, you've heard the fund. It's about 12 or 13% of the government, not touching DOD or probably Homeland Security, and just wreck these domestic programs that mean so much to so many. So we got our job cut out for us, and that's why I was hoping. And I still hope that President Obama will stand up for his workers and explain this to the American public and let people know that federal workers are not the problem. problem, no matter what this right-wing know-nothing group says, that these programs are important, they didn't cause the deficit, and they're not going to solve the deficit.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees, looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Dr. Frederick Snow, president of Grantham University. Welcome to Inside Government.
Yeah, thank you very much.
So let's talk a little about Grantham University. How long has the university been in existence?
Well, the university is just celebrating its 60th anniversary, so we've been around for quite a while. And, in fact, we're having an anniversary celebration this year with a variety of special programs and outreach, including those through the AFGE.
And what are the typical kind of students? What kind of students and student body do you serve?
Well, you know, it's really a university with an extraordinary purpose. We really serve those who serve and those who want to make a difference. And we do so by establishing a level playing field in education, specifically for those who are typically most underserved. For example, first-generation college students, active military members, government employees, those who ensure public safety, all those who need a second chance, and frankly, all those who probably never had a first chance. So a lot of adult students in our online programs.
And it sounds like it's a very diverse university. Can you talk about your commitment to diversity?
Well, certainly. We have one of the highest diversity rates in the nation, 47% diversity rate, and we're very proud of that. There are really two people that we use as our icons in terms of establishing the values within our organization. One is Abraham Lincoln, the other is Martin Luther King Jr., and we draw upon their examples and certainly in terms of the target markets that we have and the students that we serve, we are very open to everyone. We think everyone deserves a chance.
And let's also talk about Grantham University's partnership with AFGE. We've sort of partnered up and have some special programs.
Yeah, indeed. The partnership was established in 2004 with a pretty significant tuition discount, down to $250 per credit hour, which is really extraordinary in today's academic environment, as you know. It includes textbook and a software grant as well. There's also an annual scholarship that we provide. It will be launching in 2011, and there will be multiple scholarships here. The full scholarships are valued at $36,000, and that's for a recipient to earn an undergraduate or a graduate degree at Grantham. And it covers cost of tuition, textbooks, software-related fees, and actually includes a laptop as well, provided by AFGE and Purchasing Power.
And are there other future benefits that you're planning?
Well, certainly we will be working with AFGE to develop a number of programs that are specifically designed and contoured to the needs of AFGE's membership. It will be an extensive array of programs, probably 20 to 30 different programs. Those will all be putting in place in 2011. So as good as the environment is here for AFGE members right now, it will even be more so in the future.
Now, I did a little of my own investigation on Grantham, and I was very interested. You all do a lot online, but there is also a physical campus somewhere?
No, actually, we do everything online. It's 100% online. We are devoted to the adult student. We know that they really struggle to get to campuses, and so it's 100%.
But there's a base in, is it Kansas?
Yeah, well, actually, our main offices are in Kansas City, Missouri. We also have a location in Virginia as well.
Okay, and let's talk a little about online learning. I mean, Grantham has been very big in that area.
Indeed. You know, online learning has come a long way. It's been around for about 15 years or slightly less. A number of our faculty and administrators here are true veterans in this space. And we have been, organizations do it well, and we have seen other organizations do it very poorly. And I can tell you that after my first several months here and looking at the way that we conduct online learning, this is one of the best organizations out there, no question about it.
Now, to find out more information about Grantham, you all have a website, correct?
We do. It's grantham.edu. And if you'd like, if anybody would like to go and take a look, there's always somebody there sitting in the background willing to chat with you and answer questions. It's a very, very friendly environment, a friendly university. And you'll find that from the very point of contacting us that our objective is for the student to graduate, period. And we help them do that in so many ways. Every class, we help them. We encourage them. We're there for them 24/7, and it's just a wonderful way that we swaddle those students.
Now, you mentioned doing a lot of outreach to the military. A lot of folks that are in the military, active duty, and maybe even retired civilian folks, you really, in many ways, work to cater to that audience in a way. Is that right?
Oh, we do. We're really into not only the military, but public servants as well, those who protect our freedom, those who work for our government and serve this nation in that capacity. So that is really the main group of people that we serve. And we love them. I mean, it's just such a pleasure to be able to serve that group.
And let's talk about the process of an online class. If somebody, let's say, wanted to go and get a degree in criminal justice at Grantham, how do they go about that process?
Well, first of all, the process of taking an online class is fairly easy. If a person can navigate on the Internet, then most likely they'll be able to do very well in terms of navigating an online classroom. An online classroom, especially at Grantham, is not a lonely place at all. It is a social place. And it's a place where you meet people and network, and you have a professor that corresponds with you on a daily basis. And it's an exciting thing. It's not at all sterile or isolated. And the way that you get started is you just go to the website or give us a call. And it's very easy to get started. Many of our students start the same day that they call. We have classes that start every week. And we just make it so easy for students to get involved.
And you say they can start the same day that they call. Explain how that works.
Well, many students come in. It's immediately evident that they have the background to do this. We allow students to go into the classrooms and start even before they have all their transcripts come in. Certainly there's a point at which we have to complete the file, but it's not during the first class.
And what are some of the degrees that people can take at Grantham?
Well, Grantham has dozens of degrees, as you know, and they range from criminal justice to business. We have an emerging nursing program coming out. Just so many options that the person is definitely going to find what they need here. With that said, we're going to take the degrees that we have and add to a significant number to them, especially for the needs of the AFGE members.
And are there any new degrees that you're planning?
There are a number of new degrees, and we'll leave that kind of in the background for right now, but you can bet that we'll be adding to our degrees, perhaps even doubling them within the next foreseeable future.
And as you talk about people getting started, they can start class maybe even on the same day, and you say it's a very social environment. Do you use webcams so people can kind of see each other and interact?
Well, you know, that the beauty of online learning at one point in time was the fact that people could all do things at different times, and that's certainly still an advantage of online learning. Not everyone has to be in the same place at the same time. However, in the last several years, technology has really allowed us to augment those different times of getting together at certain times. And so whether it's the professor and the student or a couple students get together to discuss a project, yes, indeed, it's a webcam or Skype-based. And as I said, it's very social. It's a really wonderful experience. I can tell you that our students become very good friends. Their networks are extensive as a result of the experience. They generate lifetime friendships. And you wouldn't find that in a sterile environment, that's for sure. It's very exciting, very social.
And one of the things you mentioned is, as we have the partnership with AFGE, and you mentioned you do a lot with public servants, a lot of times people may be reluctant because they're worried about costs and things like that. Have you all worked with the federal government, the military, the VA, that sort of thing, to have classes paid for and how that process might work?
Indeed. We're very good at handling financial aid, especially through public service organizations, whether it's veterans or the tuition assistance at the military level. We have a system for Title IV funds that's being implemented right now, and though we're not issuing those funds quite yet, we're still implementing that system. So we are experts in financial aid, and you'll find that our students typically the money side of this is not an issue for them.
And tell us a little about the professors, the kind of folks that come and teach. Where do you find professors that do online learning? Because it's a little different.
We have professors all over the world, and that's actually an advantage. The professors that we have teach because they love to teach. They nearly all have real-world experience, and so they're bringing that into a classroom where the classroom represents a place that they can express themselves and share what they know. And those are the kinds of instructors that we hire, and we're fairly rigid on our instructor requirements and our instructors' performance. And so if they're not measuring up to what we think the students need, we find someone who will.
And you mentioned undergraduate classes. You offer graduate classes. Any PhD programs?
Not PhD at this point in time, no. But stick around long enough, and we'll certainly be there.
And let's talk about some of the graduate programs. We've talked about criminal justice, but what are some of the other areas?
Well, I think probably the most significant area would be business and the MBA program that we have. The Mark Skousen School of Business is named after its current dean, which is Mark Skousen. Mark Skousen is a famous economist, and he oversees the curriculum development and delivery in that school. And we are so pleased to have such a notable person so actively involved with us. There are very few schools where the schools are named after a person where that person is actually involved in the school. So in our case, in terms of the business program, there are Masters of Science, there's a Master of Business Administration and Project Management and Information Management, Masters of Science and Information Technology, Information Management and Project Management as a result as well, performance improvement, and so forth. In the Arts and Sciences, Master of Science in Health Systems Management, Nursing, RN to MSN, Master of Healthcare Administration, and so forth. So a very nice selection of master's level coursework.
And as we come into our last minute, is there anything that you'd like to add, things that maybe people should know about Grantham that they don't?
Yeah. Grantham is an extraordinarily friendly place. It really is a family. We hire for those attributes. We make sure that our professors really know what this university is about in terms of the students that we serve and the mission that we uphold and serving those who serve. And it's a place with a lot of personality. It's a place where you're taken care of and where you really do belong to something that is of substance. There are many, many online schools out there that are sort of like just generic offerings, and it's really soulless, but you won't find that at Grantham. A lot of personality, a lot of caring, a lot of passion at this university.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, did you know you have free access to all federal government job listings at your fingertips? Through AFGE's partnership with AVIEW Technologies, you can view all available jobs, apply online, and be notified when a position of interest to you becomes available. View your application progress online 24/7. You'll even get information to make you a better job applicant. Simplify your next career move with AVIEW Technologies. Log on today and check out current job openings at afge.us. That's www.afge.us and click register.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by James Green, author of Death in Haymarket, A Story of Chicago, The First Labor Movement, and the Bombing that Divided Gilded Age America. Welcome to Inside Government.
Nice to be with you.
So let's start off talking about the book. Why did you write it?
Why did I write it? Well, it's kind of a long story, but I'd always wanted to tell a epic story about American workers and immigrants and people who were critical of the way things were working in the Gilded Age, and so this was my chance to do this and to try to tell a story about working people that was also an American story that sort of put the birth of unionism right in the mainstream of the national narrative. So those were some of my goals.
And your background, you're also a professor?
I'm a professor of history here at the University of Massachusetts, Boston.
And what about the story in particular captivated your attention?
Well, I think that the sheer drama of the story made it appealing, because I thought its dramatic and suspenseful elements and indeed and tragic ending would be appealing to the general reader. In my field, many, many wonderful books written about workers and unions and strikes and working class communities, but very few of them break into the general nonfiction market, you know, the kind of people who read books about the Battle of Gettysburg or a biography of Lincoln. And I felt like this story, just the way that it evolved, had all those elements that could really make for a gripping kind of narrative, and so that was one of the reasons.
And let's talk a little about the incident itself. What exactly happened at Haymarket?
Well, it depends on how. I'll just talk about the actual incident, because the idea of the book is to go back many, many years to look at all the events that, in a sense, led up to this tragic act of violence. But the act itself, the bombing, occurs on the evening of May 4th, 1886, when there's a worker rally in the Haymarket in Chicago on the west side, called by the city's labor militants, who happened to be anarchists. There were a lot of anarchists in Chicago for reasons I could explain. And they are denouncing an act of police brutality. They call it. The previous day there had been a strike, and the police had killed a couple of immigrant strikers, so they were there to protest this. The police were very much on alert. There was a general strike going on in the city at the time for the eight-hour day, so things were very tense. But the strike had been peaceful, except for this one incident the night before where two men were killed. And so they were speaking, and the mayor came, Mayor Harrison, and he saw that the speakers were angry, but they weren't inciting to violence. They weren't calling for bomb throwing or anything like that. The mayor went to the police captain's headquarters and said, you know, it's peaceful, I'm going home, you can send home the reserves. When he left, the captain decided on his own to march on the rally and break it up. And at that point, as 176 policemen massed in this small square, someone, and to this day we don't know who it was, threw a bomb into the ranks of the police. They fired wildly about, not knowing what was happening. One officer was killed immediately. A couple of people from the rally were killed in the gunfire, and ultimately seven police officers died. And it was a very, very traumatic event, and for the city and for the country, nothing like this had happened, in peacetime before.
And what was the impact of that? What happened afterwards? What did it lead to?
That was enormous, enormous impact, shock. There had been a growing fear in cities like Chicago for years, since maybe 1871, 72, that something like this might happen, that there was this mass of angry, poor, immigrant, working people, that they somehow had absorbed ideas, communist ideas, anarchist ideas from Europe, and a small number of people had, but general fear of discontent in the lower classes. This anxiety had been building for a long time, and when the bomb actually exploded and the police officers were killed, well, it kind of produced a trauma on the one hand, the panic, a fear that this could happen anywhere in any other city, and a kind of furious desire for revenge and to put an end to this. And the way to put an end to the fear was to capture and execute the men believed to be responsible for it. So there was an immediate call for some set of lynching, but certainly a trial and execution of the men who were supposed to be responsible. The larger impact was devastating for organized labor. The American Federation of Labor had just been created that year. It was right at the moment of its birth, and so it was, affected by this. It was a lot of immigrants in the labor movement. Immigrants became suspect. How do we know that they aren't harboring bombers? How do we know that they're not subversive terrorists? So it was very, very difficult for a lot of people. And so Chicago never really recovered for a long time from this. The city became, it became much more suspicious of each other. There was much more policing and more sort of militarization of the police and the National Guard. And so these were some of the impacts.
And I know in some of Saul Alinsky's writing, when he talks about Chicago and mm-hmm. labor, there was a lot of sort of ethnic, I guess, blocks in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Was that some of the issue, or was it also a struggle against business owners?
It's all part of the same kind of boiling kettle of life in Chicago in the Gilded Age, the industrial wonder of the world, Chicago was. And it was a magnet for immigrants, huge, huge numbers of them, just as it is today. But then it was Germans. It was the largest population of German-born people outside of major cities in Germany, Chicago. The same is true of Scandinavians and Poles. So there were these enormous Bohemians, or what we would call people from Czechoslovakia, a huge community there. And these people were mixed to some extent, large Irish community, but they also lived in their own kind of ghettos, and they had their merchants and entrepreneurs, but mostly they were working people, you know, who worked in the stockyards. So they had this common experience of work and no unions and low wages and very dangerous working conditions that could bring them together. And what brought them together out of their separate ghettos was this one universal demand for the 8-hour day, because everybody could benefit from that. And that's what the strike was about when the Haymarket bomb exploded. It was a general strike for the 8-hour day, a remarkable thing. And that was really the origin of the American labor movement. And it's tragic that it had to start in such a way, because labor was really massing, it's demonstrating its strength. And when that one bomb went off, it changed everything for a while.
And why was the 8-hour day so important to the unions at that point?
Well, it's hard to think about what it might have meant now, when, you know, the 40-hour week is supposed to be the legal norm. You know, that happened. That only happened in 1938. It took a long time to get that changed. People were working 10, 11, 12 hours a day. Bakers would show up at 4 in the morning and leave at 5, you know. And so people felt like they were just living to work. And they weren't necessarily getting ahead. Today you might work a 10-hour day and get overtime, and, you know, you might be doing very well as a result. They weren't. There was no such thing as overtime pay. And they longed, because this was America, land of opportunity, to enjoy the kind of leisure life that at least a little bit of the leisure they saw among middle class and well-to-do people. But there was much more to it than that. They, at first, the 8-hour day seemed like a kind of very radical idea, because all of the employers opposed it. And so there was this sense that if we, as workers, unify and demand it and win it by the strength of our own numbers, and the employers are all opposed, and yet they're forced to concede in order to have our labor, then who knows what we can get. Because if we can get the 8-hour day, we might be able to get some kind of control over the shop floor, some kind of control over industry. So this is what interested the radical elements of the labor movement about the 8-hour day. It seemed like this opening wedge. I mean, for some people today, they'd say, well, if we ever have single-payer health care in this country, who knows what they'll ask for next? Maybe they'll ask for free public education. It was that kind of attitude, that this was a demand that could unlock the door to many, many other things that would empower working-class people.
And was there a coalition of support? I mean, religious organizations, ethnic organizations, all supporting that too?
No. And the workers were really pretty much stood alone on this matter. I think there were sympathetic priests in the parishes, the immigrant parishes, but the Catholic Church, the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, wanted nothing to do with any of these contemporary political issues. The Protestant ministers were all opposed to it. So it's the churches in those days were very conservative. The press was universally opposed to it, except for the labor press. So that's one of the reasons why radicals, in this case anarchists, emerged, because there were no other. All the sort of strength the AR movement had had to come from it in the working class. And there were people there who also saw it as a way of taking their workers' demands even further.
Now, you had mentioned that just before the incident, there was a prior incident in which police officers killed a number of protesters. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, this probably was the reason why the bombing took place when it did. If it hadn't been for this incident the night before, there may never have been a bombing in the square. There wouldn't have been a rally. One of the plants that kept operating during the general strike for the eight-hour day was this huge farm equipment manufacturing company called McCormick's, one of the premier manufacturing companies in America. It was kind of the equivalent of the Ford Motor Company today before there were cars, because every farmer wanted a mechanical harvester, and they were all made at this plant in Chicago. And the owner of the plant, Cyrus McCormick, didn't want to concede to any demands and didn't even want the unions there. He also wanted to replace the skilled workers with machinery. So there was a real standoff at this plant. And some of the workers had left in protest. Others were brought in as strike breakers. There was a lockout going on. It was a real tense situation, and that's where the confrontation occurred. When the strikers saw the strike breakers leaving the plant, they accosted them. There was a riot, and the police intervened, and that's when these two men were killed, and that's when the protest rally at Haymarket was scheduled.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Attention AFGE members, did you know you have free access to all federal government job listings at your fingertips? Through AFGE's partnership with AVIEW Technologies, you can view all available jobs, apply online, and be notified when a position of interest to you becomes available. View your application progress online 24/7. You'll even get information to make you a better job applicant. Simplify your next career move with AVIEW Technologies. Log on today and check out current job openings at afge.us. That's www.afge.us and click register.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with James Green, author of Death in Haymarket, A Story of Chicago, The First Labor Movement, and the Bombing that Divided Gilded Age America. And you suggest in the book that the reporting of the Haymarket Square or Haymarket affair was less than accurate. Well, let's talk a little about that. What were some of the omissions in the original story?
Well, the original story, I mean, I think it's fair to say that the reporting was one-sided. There was a big trial about this, and the facts are really remain in doubt and were certainly in dispute during the trial. What the newspapers did, and I think this is often the case today as well, their account of the act of violence was drawn almost entirely from police sources. So the police had their own understanding, their own version of what happened there that night, which was that this bombing was the result of a conspiracy hatched by the anarchists the night before, and that the bombing was known to people, that was planned, carried out by a cabal of people, and that when the bomb blew up, the anarchists began firing on the police, and that this was a plan to launch a general uprising in the city. And it was on that basis that seven of these anarchist labor leaders were tried and convicted of murder. That's another part of the story that we could get to later. However, during the trial, objective witnesses disputed every contention that the police made about what happened that night. So the jury, of course, believed the police, but you know, the question of what really happened there that night remains somewhat in doubt, and of course, for the newspaper reporters, there was no doubt at all what had happened. In fact, there wasn't even a bomber was never even identified or arrested or indicted. So the men who were held responsible, none of them were accused of actually throwing the bomb. They were only accused of conspiring with the unknown bomber. So you can see this is an extraordinary prosecution also that was being conducted here. It's very rare to have a conspiracy trial when you don't have the perpetrator on trial, the perpetrator of the crime.
And I noticed later in the book you draw some parallels to the other Chicago Seven.
Well, it's parallels. Well, Chicago history has a strange way of circling back on itself. The days of rage in Chicago when the militant anti-war activists came to the city and engaged in acts of civil disobedience and violence against property. Then they were arrested and tried, and it was a famous case, of course, in our time, Judge Hoffman's courtroom with Abby Hoffman and Bobby Seale. And there are curious similarities in the two cases. And in fact, the people who were on trial in 1969 were very much aware of what had happened in 1886 and drew some connections between what they were doing and what the anarchists were doing back in the day. But, of course, it was a completely different time. History never repeats itself exactly, but we do see some curious resonances sometimes in current events and what had happened a long time ago.
Now, also early on in the book, you introduced the readers to William Silvis. Tell us a little about him.
Yes, well, for a labor union audience, I think he's a very important and probably unknown figure. I think we think of Samuel Gompers as the sort of creator, originator, godfather, if you will, of the American union movement. And in some ways he was, because he was the genius who guided the American Federation of Labor through its early years. But before Gompers founded the AFL with others in 1886, there was the first labor movement, the beginnings of it in the Civil War, when William Silvis, who was the head of the Iron Molders Union, organized the first really strong national union with a dues-paying membership, the treasury, agreements with employers. And it was Silvis who then launched attempts to reform many aspects of American life. He was a supporter of the Emancipation Proclamation and of Reconstruction in the South. He was a supporter of women's suffrage, of racial integration, and most importantly for my story, the one who kicked off the 8-hour day movement. And he was trying, this is in a few years after Lincoln died, to bring everyone together in a house of labor. And he wasn't able to do that. And he died at a young age in 1869. So in some ways, the labor movement that he was trying to create was still born. But he was a very visionary leader. Gompers, more practical, more pragmatic. Let's just limit our demands to the everyday working conditions and hours. And Silvis had a much larger vision of what economic justice would be like in the American workplace.
And let's talk a little about that. What was his vision, and what kind of tactics did he use to try to implement that?
Well, for him, the 8-hour day was, as I said earlier, a real wedge to trying to create some, I guess I would call it some equity, some democracy in the workplace. It wasn't simply about a living wage and a reasonable working day. It was a partnership that he saw between the people who did the work and those in his industry, it was men, who did the work and the people who happened to own the capital, that this shouldn't be a subservient relationship, that this shouldn't be a deferential relationship, that it should be one in which both parties had equal rights, that the ownership of capital didn't entitle the capitalist to any more rights or powers or privileges than workers, because this was what Lincoln had said before he died, that without labor there is no capital. We're not just employees, we're not just wage earners, we're partners in production, and without our skills and our labor power, you can't make any profit. So there was this sense that we should really be in this in some cooperative way together.
You know, you mentioned that this was one of the first where there was an actual like dues structure, and obviously, you know, pay was a lot worse way back then than it is now, and you know, nobody ever wants to pay money when you don't have it.
Yeah.
How successful was he able to do that? I mean, that seems to be a precursor to how all unions that are effective are organized today.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was very persuasive, and this was a new, I think there probably were some other unions who collected dues. You know, there were some strong organizations among locomotive engineers and printers and so forth, but Silvis really had a much more ambitious plan for the Iron Molders Union, and it would be a real fighting organization, and that it would really be able to conduct strike support activities where one group of molders, say the McCormick's plant in Chicago, had a dispute that the national organization could come to their aid. And so he really persuaded these molders, who were, relatively speaking, well paid. They were sort of the top of the food chain in the skilled trades, because there was no steel then. Everything that people used, the stoves, the rails for the railroad, the copper kettles, the tools, it was all made out of molded iron. So these men were really at the very center of American manufacturing. And so they had a reasonable wage compared to what a lot of people did. And so anyway, Silvis had to convince them to contribute, you know, dues for the larger good, one for all and all for one, an injury to one is the concern of all. That was the kind of appeal that he made.
As we talk about the significance of the Haymarket Affair today in the history of the labor movement, how significant would you rank this?
You know, I think its significance for today is maybe as a little, has something to do with labor today. I mean, I think we're at a point now where in the private sector, I mean, some of us who belong to unions in the public sector might see this differently, but the people who are in industry today don't have union protection, and I think they may someday want to have that. So there may be some resonance in the events of 1886 for today's immigrant workers. It's such a different scene that we have now in collective bargaining that, you know, I wouldn't want to say there are specific lessons. I think the lessons may be much broader ones, or the questions that arise from this about how our judicial system, how our media, how our public opinion treats, how about Congress treats matters of public safety and national security when there's an act of violence like this. Do we suspend due process for certain groups of people who might be suspected of committing acts like this, or might be suspected of knowing terrorists, or to be from groups that are known to have terrorists among them, this kind of thing? This is, a lot of people who read the book have found it, even though I didn't say anything about this explicitly, found it very troublingly contemporary in terms of the questions that are being raised about our own government's war on terror and the Patriot USA Act and the people in Guantanamo Bay, the prisoners there, and the kind of suspension of civil liberties, lots of immigrants being held in confinement without habeas corpus, this kind of thing. That all appeared for the first time after Haymarket, and I think when people read about that, they see some troubling connections with concerns they have about what's happening today.
And as we come into our last minute, you bring up an interesting point about May Day and May 1 versus Labor Day. Give us, if you can, in a minute or less, some history on that.
Yeah, it can be very quick. In 1890, May 1st became the International Workers' Holiday all over the world, and I think it was in America as well. And it was, however, proclaimed by the Socialist Congress in Europe. And so I think the Gompers and the President Cleveland and the American Federation of Labor and others didn't want to be, they wanted their own American holiday that was specifically, has to do with it was a national, an expression of nationalism against socialism. So in 1894, Congress created a Labor Day in September. But you know, May Day is coming back now in the United States. There's going to be a huge celebration of the anniversary of the first May Day in Chicago this year. And the unions are beginning to see again that this hasn't, this is a day that represents international solidarity, which is something that unions are very eager to pursue these days.
We want to say thank you to our guests this week, AFGE National President John Gage, Grantham University President Dr. Frederick Snow, and author James Green. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, and AVU Technology.